Pano Yasa Bhagavato Savaka Sangho Tamayang Bhagavantang Sadhamang Sasangang Ime hi sakave hi atavahang avopite hi abhipujayama sadhuno bhante bhagava suchira parinipotopi Pachima janata nukampa manasa Ime sakave dugata panna kalabhute patiganhatu Amhakang dikharatang Hitaya sukaya alaham sama sambodho bhagava buddhang bhagavantang abhivademi suakato bhagavata dhammo Dhammang namassami Supatipanno Bhagavato Savaka Sangho Sanghang namami Namo tassa Bhagavato Arahato Sama Sambuddhasa Namo Tassa Bhagavato Arahato Sama Sambuddhasa Namo Tassa Bhagavato Arahato Sama Sambuddhasa Iti piso bhagava arahang sama sambuddho Vijacharana sampanno sukhato lokavidu Anuttaro purissa dhamma sarati satate Vamanu sanang buddho bhagava Tamahang bhagavantang abhipujayami Tamahang bhagavantang sirasa namami Suvakato Bhagavata Dhammo Sanditiko Akaliko Ehipasiko Opanayiko Pachatang Veditabo Vinyuhi Tamahang Dhammang Abhipujayami Tamahang Dhammang Sirasa Namami Supatipanno Bhagavato Savaka Sangho Ujjupatipanno Bhagavato Savaka Sangho Yaya Patipanno Bhagavato Savaka Sangho Samichi Patipanno Bhagavato Savaka Sangho Yadidang Chatari purisa yugani ata purisa pugala esa bhagavato sāvaka-saṅgho āhuneyo pāhuneyo dākhineyo āñcalikaraṇiyo anuttaraṁ puṇyakhetaṁ lokasā tamahaṁ saṅghaṁ abhipuchayami tamahaṁ saṅghaṁ sirasā namāmi.
This is what should be done by one who is skilled in goodness and who knows the path of peace. Let them be able and upright, straightforward and gentle in speech, humble and not conceited, contented and easily satisfied, not busy with duties and frugal in their ways, peaceful and calm and wise and skillful, not proud and demanding in nature. Let them not do the slightest thing that the wise would later reprove, wishing in gladness and in safety. May all beings be happy, whatever living beings there may be, whether they are weak or strong, omitting none, the great or the mighty, medium, short or small, the seen and the unseen, those living near and far away, those born and to be born, may all beings be happy. Let none deceive another or despise any being in any state. Let none through anger or ill will wish harm upon another, even as a mother protect with her life her child, her only child. So with a boundless heart should one cherish all living beings, radiating kindness over the entire world, spreading upwards to the skies and downwards to the depths, outwards and unbounded, free from hatred and ill will, whether standing or walking, seated or lying down, free from drowsiness. One should sustain this recollection. This is said to be the sublime abiding, by not holding to false use, the pure-hearted one, having clarity of vision, being free from all sense desires, is not born again into this.
Ho, ho, ho.
Excellent. There we go. So here we go. How can daily fights with people you live with be resolved? Oh, if it's daily fights. We had this, I think I've told a few of these things before, how daily fights. First of all, if you mean real fights with fists, that's not very good. But if it's a lot of time, I think you probably mean just shouting matches. And somebody once told me that the reason why we shout at one another is because we are emotionally distant from one another. So, this is my bodyguard this evening. Be careful. Anyone who asks a cheeky question. Now there are some, oh, this is Venerable Kassapa. But you know, some of the monks, they come from really interesting backgrounds. This monk is just an ordinary background, I think. At least he hasn't told me. But there was this one monk, and he told me that how he became a Buddhist monk. I don't know if anyone's ever met Venerable Karuniko. Not the nun, the monk. He's from Birmingham. And he spent a range retreat here, a year here or somewhere. A really lovely monk. But I only found out that his background was that he was a martial artist. He was a second dan black belt karate. And you would never think, he's a big fellow, but he was just so soft and kind. You'd never ever sort of be scared in his presence. But he told me the reason he became a monk was that he was in a competition, you know, in karate, black belt, in the public, and he was matched against another second dan black belt karate expert, a girl, a woman. And, you know, so they were pretty evenly matched as they fought one another. This is why it came up, daily fights with people you live with be resolved. But, you know, it was like a competition, you know, according to rules. And, you know, it was pretty sort of fierce stuff. You know, these were not sort of lightweights. These were experts, you know, just, they could probably just chop my head off with one slash of the wrists. But he was fighting and he told me he got into this very strange state of samadhi, of stillness. And he just put all his guards down. Just basically asking this second dan belt, just hit me wherever you want. And he couldn't be hurt. He was invulnerable. And she was smashing him this way, smashing him that way. No harm, no bruises, no hurt. And it was such a weird experience. I mean, really focused, totally letting go, and a second dan black belt could not even bruise him. Now they're hitting him, but nothing happened. And that was such a weird experience that he wanted to take it deeper and just find out what the heck's going on. And that's where he started doing meditation and learning just about sort of how to make the mind peaceful and quiet. So, if you have a daily fight with someone you live with, learn how to get into jhana and just say, hit me. But for him, it actually worked. That was so strange what you can do. But also the daily fights, is it people making decisions, who's right and who's wrong? And that's why, I think I already mentioned, I think it's such a well-known story, the chicken and the duck. Is it, you know that story, don't you? Yeah, okay. Is it really worthwhile just arguing? Because most of the fights you have are over small stuff, simple stuff. It's not worth a fight. If that's what your wife wants to do, let her do it. If that's what the husband wants to do, let him do it. Stop having daily fights. But anyway, what I was going with shouting at one another, a monk pointed out that if you shout at one another, you usually shout because you're a long way away. So I know sometimes you shout at someone just right in the corner, hey, can you please sort of turn up the air conditioner or turn it down? Because they're a long way away, you have to raise your voice. But if they're very close, they're just sitting next to you, you just have to whisper because you don't need to raise your voice. So he was saying that when you raise your voice and shout at somebody, they may be right next to you in the same room. It means that you physically you're close, but emotionally you're very distant. And if it's somebody who you're emotionally close to, you don't need to raise your voice. You just speak very softly because they're emotionally close to you. I thought it was a very good observation why people shout, even though they're in the same room. It's because you may be close physically, but emotionally you're a long way apart. So, how do we resolve these things? First of all, it's difficult when you're in a relationship making decisions and finding out who's right and who's wrong, because you have to make a decision somehow or other. So, you know how frustrating it is arguing? And why is it that, he always has to be right? I tell you why he has to always be right. It's because you looked a long way, you really searched for Mr. Right, and now you found him. A man is made of the right stuff. He always has to be right. No. But instead of that, that sometimes when people argue who's right and who's wrong, and you can't make any decision. You don't know who's right and who's wrong until later on, and maybe you don't even know at all. So because of that, even if you are, if the woman is the most wisest professor of logic and knows everything, you still will not be able to convince your husband he's wrong. Forget it. You may be a top lawyer and you can get anybody off any charge because you're such a good argument, but you can't convince your husband he's wrong. The same your husband or the man. Doesn't matter if he is a second-hand car salesman who can sell a donkey to a sheik. Is that a good simile? I don't know. But nevertheless, you'll never be able to convince your wife that she's wrong. It's a waste of time. So instead of wasting your time convincing your wife that she's wrong, convincing your husband he's wrong, doesn't matter how much evidence you have, you'll never be able to do that. You're wasting time and creating a lot of bad feelings. So instead, we use what we call the calendar method. You know the calendar method? It's a wonderful way for settling arguments in a marriage. Very simple. You don't need to do any research or any logical arguments or state all the facts or get all the information from the internet about why you're right and why he's right or you're right or someone's right. What you do is you just look at the calendar. And if it's an odd day of the month, first, third, fifth, seventh, ninth, and so on, she's right. If it's an even day of the month, then second, fourth, sixth, eighth, tenth, then he's right. It's so simple. It means you don't have any arguments. Just look at the calendar. And that was working so well here in Australia. But then there came a glitch. And the glitch was when they instituted same-sex marriage. Which means one day of the month, the even days say, they're both right. And on the other day, none of them are right. That was the end of that idea. But it's not just a joke. It's just saying, well, why argue? There's no way that you can sort of convince the other partner that you're right and wrong. And a lot of times, you feel so awful. You feel bad about, you know, arguing with somebody. You know, actually, believe it or not, you care for one another. And, There was this, I think Sompong remembers her, this Lady Poonsop. She was Thai Chinese, and her husband was called George. And, oh, Poonsop just ruled the roost. She wore the trousers. She told George everything, what he had to do. She treated him just so badly, even during the ceremony. George, stupid man, come over here. George, go and get this. George. And eventually, no, she passed away, she died. And I asked George, I always thought, you must be so happy that... you don't get told off anymore. And he said, no, I miss her so much. It's crazy, isn't it? She just gave his life so much misery, but then he missed her when she went. Fascinating. But there's another part to that story, because Poonsop, she said, I don't trust my husband at all, not anyways. And, you know, she was getting very sick, and I'll tell all the stories with Poonsop, she won't mind. But anyway... when she was getting very sick, you know, she asked for some of this holy water. If you go over to Bodhinyana, sprinkle people with holy water. She said, oh, I need some holy water. I mean, she really was sick. She was in a wheelchair. And so she asked for a whole bucket of it, you know, an 11-litre bucket. You know, sometimes people actually, they do shower with it. And I was very happy and I was very kind, never asking any questions, trusting everybody, really nice, kind monk. And then week after week, a whole bucket. And then, one day, here in Serpentine, in Bodhinyana Monastery, I got a call and said, is that Ajahn Brahm? I said, yes. Can I go and buy some holy water? I said, no, we don't sell these things. You don't buy it. Oh, yes, you do. I said, no, I don't. I just give it away. Well, I get my supply from Mrs. Poonsop Wong. And I want to cut out the middle man or middle woman. So I want to buy it directly from the source. It's really good, you know, I really need it. And then I found out why Mrs. Wong. She was buying 11 litres, then bottling it and selling it on. She had a nice little business going there for a while until someone decided to... Anyway, so, no, she was, you know... not that wealthy, but she didn't trust George, and so she came to me one day and said, look, you know, I'm going to die in about, you know, 3 or 4 months, and look, I can't trust George, my husband, to arrange a funeral. He's stupid. Right in front of him. And so he said, can the Buddhist Society arrange the funeral for me? And basically that I will give you like half of the little apartment they had in Maylands. I said, look, I can't do deals like that. I'm a monk. But, you know, I can tell the committee and see what they say. And so our little committee, they had a look at it and thought, well, actually, this is the cost of a funeral and, you know, the getting half of the house, you know, in the will. No, it's actually a really good deal for the Buddhist Society. So they approved it. So I did the funeral for her when she died. And after she died, you know, we're not people who go around and knocking on George's door and say, oh, cough up, where's the funeral money? where's half their house? We're not people like that. So, you know, just after a little while, we asked him, we said, you know, did you find the will? And he said, no, I've lost it. I can't find it anywhere. I said, okay, well, never mind. You know, just, you know, kindness is more important than the money. And then he appeared in a taxi in Bodhinyana Monastery one morning, and they cost a lot of money, taxis. And he was just so agitated. And, you know, I said, what are you here so early for? Here's the will, Ajahn, take it now. So what happened? Boots up. She came last night and woke me up as a ghost. George, you know where that will is. Get that will now for the monks and take it to them straight away. And she was already dead. And I've never seen the poor fellow just so scared. He couldn't give me that will. He always knew where it was. He was just hiding it. And the ghost of his wife came in the middle of the night. She didn't even let him alone when she was dead. And that's actually a true story. That's what happened. And I feel so sorry for George. But anyway, fights with people who live with be resolved. Remember, your wife or your husband will die one day. And if they die before you, be careful. They will come and get their own back. Husband! Anyway, so people who live with be resolved. One serious method is to get the old piece of paper. Get a piece of paper, A4 sized, line is best, and then you draw a line down the middle with a ruler. On the top, you put the name of your partner, the one you fight with. And then on the left-hand side of that piece of paper, all the reasons why you just married a stupid person, a person who should know better, why you fight with him or her, your partner, all his faults and defects. Put that down there on the left-hand side. And once you've filled out the left-hand side, which is pretty easy, put the faults and defects in your partner, then in the right-hand side, you put all his fine qualities, all his goodness, his beautiful part to his character. And that takes more time. But you have to fill it out. All the things which is why other people respect him, his kindness, his goodness, his sacrifice, or her goodness, sacrifice. And then once you've filled out on the right-hand side, then you get the pair of scissors. You cut it carefully down the middle line. On the left-hand side, all the reasons why you fight because there's a stupid partner you've chosen to live with. You screw that up and put it in the trash can. The right-hand side, all their good qualities. You actually laminate. Oh, you photocopy it, first of all. Laminate it. Leave copies in your office, by your bed, in your bag, everywhere, even a screensaver on your mobile device. Just to remind you that this person you fight with has got some amazing, wonderful, good qualities. And the trouble is you forget about those as you focus on their faults. And when you do that, you look, this is the partner I live with. Yeah, he's not perfect, but he's got some beautiful qualities. And when you see their beautiful qualities, you remind yourself of their good qualities, then you find that they show you their good qualities more and more and more, and they become a wonderful partner to live with. Just like I told the story before about the professor in Singapore, who was the head of the schizophrenia unit in Singapore, and he said, I don't treat schizophrenia. I treat the other part of the patient. So you don't even treat the bad part of the partner you live with, the thing that causes you to fight with them. You treat the other part, the good, the kind, the wonderful part in your partner. And then that just grows and blossoms. When we focus on faults, of course we fight. when we focus on the good part, then we've got peace and harmony together. That's how it works. Is the law of attraction true? The secret. Of course it's not, but the law of attraction is, if people who sell stupid books attract lots of stupid people to make lots of money. Is it the power of our mind that we create what we think? Wouldn't that be easy if you can create what you think? Do an experiment, try it. Think of your partner and create him into being the perfect partner. Can you do that? Some man, you know what men are like, they said, I'll give you a wish. And he said, oh, you know, I've got, my wife is getting old. So, man, can I have a wife who's 20 years younger than me? And he was about 60. And his wish was granted, and he came out, and he was 80. I want to be 60, but one was... Anyway, you know what I'm talking about. The law of attraction, true. Now, it's sometimes that aspiration sometimes works. That especially like, even like fear. It's amazing how many times what you're afraid of is what you actually create. You're afraid that, you know, you may get a disease and goodness me, you get it. But if you just think positively, it's, oh, it doesn't matter, you know, if I get a disease, fine, if I don't, fine. You tend to be free of diseases. So the law of attraction, the most important part is karma. You get what you deserve, what you need. Just like this old prisoner I remember seeing over in Karnat prison farm many years ago. And he said he really needed to talk to me because he was put in jail for a crime he didn't do. Many people say that, but he said, look, honestly, I did not do that robbery. Someone else did. He said, I won't lie to you, Ajahn Brahm. I respect you, you know, good monk, kind monk. I'm trying to be a good person myself. I never did that robbery. And when people say things like that, I know when you're in jail, you just don't get much opportunity to redress wrongs. You don't have any money and you don't only one phone call a week or something and no friends, no support. And so I thought, well, I can't let this pass. You know, the poor fellow's in jail for something he never did. So I started thinking of all the lawyers, the Buddhist lawyers I knew, and just how we can get someone to do this for pro bono, in other words, for free, to help this poor guy. And as I was thinking, what I can do when I get back to the monastery to help this person who's put in jail for something he didn't do, that's when he grinned at me, this really cheeky smile. And he said, but, Ajahn Brahm, there were so many robberies where I wasn't caught, which I got away with. I guess this is fair. That was the karma. He was put in prison for a robbery he didn't do, but as many robberies he did do where he wasn't caught. So I thought this was karma balancing it. So how many times do you get caught by a speed camera or something? And this is really unfair. Other cars were speeding as well, but you're the one who gets caught and gets the fine. How many of you think that every time you are speeding and there's not a speed camera there, do you think that's unfair that you weren't fined? No, of course not. So this is actually why sometimes attraction, it's not really attraction, it's that karma, it balances out. Good evening, Ajahn. I'm a person always occupied by doubts. Are you? Are you sure about that? Doubt your doubts. Should I find ways to overcome doubts before I meditate, or should I use meditation to overcome my doubts? Just the best thing to do is that doubts are just often the case. Yes, no. Investigate doubts. Find out what doubts really are. Use doubt as the object of your meditation. Interesting. Sometimes, you know, when people say they're depressed. Do you know what depression really is? Depression is really interesting. You should actually do a personal in-depth study of depression. And it gets, now when you're depressed, it gets so interesting. Of course, you're not depressed anymore. All right, boredom. Do you know what boredom is? Investigate boredom. Take an interest in boredom. They're using a bit of reverse psychology. So anyway, if you've got lots of doubts, then just, can you doubt this present moment? What are you experiencing right now? The reality of being a little bit cold or tired? That's something. Can you doubt sort of the water on your body as you take a shower? Can you doubt when you just sit down and on the stupa and just feel the sun on your body, on your face? That's a reality you can't doubt. It's right there, right with you. Thinking, that's full of doubts. You know, is this going to, or the future especially, is this going to happen or that going to happen? Even the past. You know, people trust the past so much when every psychologist knows that your memory of the past is more faithful to what you thought should have happened rather than what actually happened. And sometimes we think, for example, where did you leave your shoes before you came in here? Were they on the, as you go out, the left side of the door or the right side of the door? Which way were they pointing? A lot of times we don't remember these things. Actually, sometimes even we create the past to suit ourselves for what we think should have happened, what we think we should have done with our shoes. And I say that because I remember reading an article about the police who have to interview people after, say, a traffic incident. And they interview the people, and they've just seen the accident, and then they give such conflicting observations of what happened. Because even when we've just seen something, which is, you know, quite confronting, we remember only a part of the scene, and we fill in the rest with what we think should have happened. That is one of the problems. Well, we've seen those experiments they did in psychology. I remember they just, I think it was done in Harvard, and they had these workmen, one of the students went up to the victim actually to ask them, which is the way to the Senate building or something. And before the person could answer, the two of the other psychology teachers or something, people in on what was happening, they walked right between these two people with a big door. They're pretending to be workmen. So you're having a conversation with you, and then somebody goes right between you with a door. And so that then they ask the question again, now where's the Senate building? And the person who's asking that question, they would change these persons. The one who asked the question first would actually go with the door, and the next person would come in afterwards to see if the people who had asked the question noticed the questioner was changing. Do you understand that, what was happening? But they did that because they changed these people from like an Afro-American and then to sort of an Hispanic, a girl, boy, young, old, and people didn't realize the questioner had changed because they're not supposed to change. That was not really supposed to happen. The same person, just the door came in to take the first questioner away and the second questioner replaced them. And the people being asked didn't notice. You only perceive what you think is important and you fill in the rest, which is one of the reasons why our memories are very unreliable. And most psychologists know that. What actually happened, are you sure? I'm dead sure. And somebody else says, no, the opposite thing happens. Who can know? But even the past is uncertain. Isn't that good? It means we don't have to argue about who did what, because we don't know. So give them the benefit of the doubt. if living is suffering and living beings must seek to get out of it, why don't we all not exist in the first place? That's a good idea, but it's a bit late now, isn't it? You're already here. Big mistake. I know that we are born because of karma, but no being would be born if we never existed. Yeah, so you do exist. So that's actually called in science a bootstrap theory. Because you are, therefore other people will be. Because that's true. No being would be born if we never existed. Exactly, but I mean, you can't go back and de-exist. Here you are. So you better just work with the reality of your existing and just see what you can do about it. Can someone experience jhana even with the eyes open and sober? If you have the eyes open, it'd be like, you know, what I was saying, the looking at that wall and it disappears. If your eyes are open, as long as nothing is moving in front of you, the sense of sight doesn't get stimulated, so it just turns off. And when the five senses turn off, that's when the jhana happens. So it can, but you have to just be looking at something really black wall. You can't enter jhana if you're looking at a movie. With your eyes open. Can you teach me how to develop a more loving and caring heart? That's what I've been doing for the last 4 or 5 days. Haven't you been paying attention? But if it hasn't worked yet, Ajahn means teacher. Ajahn teddy bear. So, Sayadaw bear. What else do you call it? Sifu. Sifu bear. So see if you can get a bear and actually just cuddle it. And it teaches you a lot. This isn't just, you know, like kindergarten Buddhism. That's just for sort of childish meditators. This actually works. And so if you can get your bear and you just really cuddle it, you actually open the door of your heart. Reason for a teddy bear is because in many cultures, the teddy bear is, you know, just reminds you of the safety, the simplicity, the kindness of your childhood. But it also reminds you of like safety, warmth, it's nice and soft and non-threatening, and it just elicits, it just incites, you know, brings out some of that beautiful, simple kindness in something which is non-threatening. And so once you start with a teddy bear and you feel really kind and feel warm, you start to open your heart to a teddy bear, then it's easy to open the door of your heart to other things as well. And you look at your husband, look at him, he's just a big teddy bear, that's all he is. Look at your wife, ah, oh, she's just a little teddy girl. Is that right? I don't know. A female teddy bear. And so you can see at people that just, oh, they're quite cute and lovable. And I've never met anybody in this world who's not cute and lovable. They're just kind, beautiful people. I don't know why you can't get on with each other. Yeah, you do stupid things, say stupid things, but now look deeper than that. That's only the outermost petals of the lotus. Now look up deeper than that. Now poor old Mr. Trump. No one loves him, except himself. So imagine if you sent him a teddy bear and just you started hugging it and feeling sort of at peace with yourself or whatever, and just forgive and be kind to one another. Then because he's kind to one another, just you go to, and he always got that with Mr. Trump, not Mr. Kim. But apparently when I was talking about teddy bears, especially that famous teddy bear, Winnie the Pooh, when I was talking about that in Hong Kong, they said, Ajahn Brahm, don't mention Winnie the Pooh. I said, why? And apparently, that somebody compared the current president of China with Winnie the Pooh. So from now on, I can't mention Winnie the Pooh when I go to Hong Kong. Anyway. Can someone experience jhana more than one time, or it could be 100 times? Yeah, you can experience jhana heaps and heaps and heaps of times. Don't you agree, Teddy Bear?
Yes.
Hey, Ajahn, often when I meditate, I feel tingling sensations flowing through my body, but it got stuck in my stomach, and then my stomach felt bloated, even itchy in some pain, usually on left area. Last night, the bloating pain lasted even after meditation finished. Does it mean that I meditated the wrong way, or is it a healing process, since I do have some gastric stuff? Usually, if your body starts to tingle, it means the body is usually about to disappear, but it could be, and it sounds more likely, that when the body starts to tingle, just don't stay with the body, just go with something like the breath. Keep the body on the outside, but the breath in the center, and just let the energy flow into a delightful breathing rather than delightful body. Because you know, this is where some energy, it's where the kundalini sort of starts. And for a lot of people, that's quite big energy, but it's not really meant to be in the body. It's supposed to be in the mind. And I gave a talk to the monks some years ago. I compared it to a leaky bucket. Now, if you're carrying a leaky bucket, the water goes all over your body and gets you soaked. The water should stay in the bucket. That sort of energy should stay in your mind, and you get beautiful breath, nimittas, a lot of energy. That's where the thing belongs. But if you get a bloating pain and itchy in your tummy, that may be the case that the energy is going to the wrong place. That may be the case. But anyway, if you usually have some gases, do have some gastric issue, that also could be going there. But if it really is the energy going to places which really need it to heal, you always feel so peaceful afterwards and so wonderful. It's as if you can feel that sort of gastric issue, but it gets so much lighter and so much more peaceful. So it's more to me that I would actually, if I did have any money, I'd put the money on. I can't bet. I can't do any wages, but I would imagine it's you've got the tingling feeling through your body, and you should allow that to go into your mind rather than into the body. So you know, watch something like a breathing. Get it very beautiful, and then just lights coming up, and you can't feel the body. And that's the best. Dear Ajahn Brahm, the guided meditation this afternoon is very good, but... Oh, that's terrible, the buts. I couldn't hear some of the content. Could you please tell us one more time how to do it? Loudly and slowly. Thank you very much. It's all recorded, isn't it? I think so. All this guided meditation. If it's guided meditation and it's recorded, you can actually get a copy of that and play it at maximum volume. And actually slow it down. Because all these even guided meditations and talks, you know, they're not planned. And they're not repeatable, in the sense that if someone says, oh, that was a really good talk or good meditation, can you repeat it? You can't. I tried that sometimes, and it just never works. You have to be in this moment, and sometimes you tune in to what you're thinking or what you're doing, which is why you actually do a meditation which suits people. But the moment goes. And it changes, so you can't repeat it. That's why the only way to actually repeat those types of meditation is to actually to record it. Can you make more guided meditation for health issues? Yeah, sure. But we have a lot of those guided meditations. And again, just see if you can download them. And just... And of course, you can share them with anybody. There's no copyright and there's no fees involved. So let people... That's one, again, one of the reasons why when that person called up, they said, Ajahn Brahm, you teach meditation. I said, yeah. How much do you charge? And the first time I said, nothing, it's for free, because that's our tradition. And then they said, well, you can't be any good then. Isn't that crazy to think that the more you charge, the better you must be? That's why people come on these retreats. I mean, these retreats, well, I'm not quite sure how much they charge to all the aircraft and stuff, but it's still pretty cheap. There was, after the conference I gave in San Francisco, I think Angie, you know, she was going to take the opportunity to do 1 week retreat at Spirit Rock, which was $1,000 for the retreat. I think it was food was extra or something. It was incredibly expensive. So this is not just cut price. This is high value, low cost. This is a bargain. You know why? Because I don't charge. So sometimes people sort of get the wrong idea. Well, if it's so cheap, it can't be any good. So these days, when people say, how much does it cost, you know, to go on a retreat, or how much does it cost to go to one of your meditation sessions, or I never say it's for free anymore. I say it's priceless. And this other lady, she was a Polish lady, called once, and she said, I want to come to your meditation class this afternoon. Doctor told me to go. I said, now how much do you charge? And I said, I don't charge anything, it's priceless. And then she paused and she said, you don't understand. Dollars, cents. How much I have to give you, you know, for the class. I said, look, Maddie, you don't have to pay any dollars or cents or nothing, it's just free. And he said, no, how much do I have to, she said, how much do I have to cough up for your class? So there's nothing, it's for free, we don't do things like that, we don't sell this. And then she paused. And then the nice part of this conversation was when she said, well, what do you get out of it then? And I said, happiness. And that was actually a very serious answer. What do you get out of giving? Happiness. And actually she paused and, oh, that's interesting. You're really teaching her some wonderful Dhamma. What do you get out of giving? It's happiness. Anyway, guided meditations. I try and do as many as I can during this retreat, but anyway. My sister recently had a dream that a chief Mahayana monk who passed away 10 years ago, wow, came to her dream to ask for a donation to his monastery, or his monastery in the heaven realms. Is it possible for a monk who passed so long ago to send a message like this? Thank you. First of all, they wouldn't send a message for you to give a donation. That's not what. Well, they must be in a really sort of a terrible realm where they've still got greed. So, no, they don't do things like that. Because, you know, that some of the dreams we have, do you really believe in your dreams? There was this man here in Perth some years ago who dreamt of five angels. You know the story? He had this really clear dream. Five angels came to him, and each angel had five big pots of gold. And they lined up to give him each five big pots of solid gold. And it was worth a fortune. And when he received the last pot of gold, he woke up. You know what happens in those dreams? You have these very clear dreams, and then at the very end you wake up. And he looked around his bedroom, and he couldn't see any angels there at all. He didn't mind that, because he couldn't find any gold either. That was really upsetting. It was just a dream. But then he went down for breakfast. His wife that morning, really weird, had made him five pieces of toast and five boiled eggs. Why, he didn't know. And he thought, this is really weird. And he looked in the newspaper. It was the 5th of May. the fifth day of the fifth month. He thought, this is really strange. And he looked in the back of the newspaper where they had the horse racing. Here in Perth is a racing course named after a famous one in UK called Ascot. A-S-C-O-T. Five letters. He looked in race number five that afternoon, and he couldn't believe his eyes. Horse number five, race number five that afternoon, was called Five Angels. Whoa. And he realized these things. He had the dream, five big pots of gold, lots of money from five angels. And he thought, this is the only maybe get these omens, maybe once in a lifetime, if at all. So he took the afternoon off work, and he went to the bank first and took out, he had to keep the lucky number five, he took out $5,000. He went to the racetrack, and his bookkeeper's windows, he chose the fifth one. And he put $5,000 to win. Horse number five, race number five, five angels. He knew the lucky number five could not be wrong. The lucky number five was not wrong. His horse came in fifth. So sometimes dreams, we just misinterpret them. So be careful. No, that's really crazy stuff. 10 years dead and came to ask for a donation to his monastery. Goodness gracious. I try to do two sittings per day, but in the evening, sitting around 9:30 p.m., I usually doze off, peace advice. Well, do the second sitting before 9:30 p.m. It's 24 hours every day. What about in the afternoon or in the morning time? Oh, so anyway, change your schedule so you can do some meditation earlier. But anyway, what's the best time to meditate?
Now.
Now, correct. What's the worst time to meditate? Later on. Do it now. How to face aging and death peacefully. Die young. Look, where? Okay, I think I'll leave it at that. Look, when you've got an old car, do you keep it going? In many places in this world, every time you got an old car after a certain 10 years, 20 years, you have to go and get it checked. It costs a lot of money. So, when you get really old, can't you sort of change this old car, this old body into a new model? So that's the law of karma, reincarnation. So if you die and if you paid off all your insurance premiums every year, done a lot of good karma, then in your next life you get a much better model of a body. Anyway. But if you are old and you are dying, we get the best use out of it. This is it's actually next week or two. 7th of August, how long is that? That's not that long. I'm 68 this year. Full 68 years. And so, the people told me, 68, you should be retired by now, living on a pension. But anyway, they said, well, at least you can get, what they call like a Commonwealth seniors card, Commonwealth of Australia. So I thought, well, why not? And I don't get anything out of it, because I can, why not? So I went online and to actually know how old you have to be to get a seniors card. I think it's 60. I should have got one years ago. So I went online it used to be Centrelink or something, the social security thing, and to fill in the forms. But they said, no, I need to go to the office to prove my identity, because there's identity fraud these days. So I had to go in there and just take any ID I had with me. So I made an appointment. I went to the local office in Armidale, and I sat down, and the woman who was doing the case said, can you prove who you are? And I said, I've been trying to answer that question for the last 45 years as a monk. She didn't think it was funny. There's only a few Buddhists around here, or people interested in spirituality. Who are you? But they said, no, I want some ID. I said, well, what ID do you want? He said, what about your driving license? I don't have a driving license. As a monk. Okay, what about your credit card? Don't have one of those either. What about your rental agreement or your home ownership? I don't own anything. I live in a little cave, you know, which is owned by the Buddhist Society. I don't pay rent. I said, okay, well, what about any rental agreement you have for anything? So I don't have any, I don't rent anything. Well, what about your, you know what she asked me next? Honestly, no exaggeration, what about your marriage license? I'm not married. And she's getting more and more frustrated because all the things which define you in this life, like your mobile phone, I don't have one of those. And he said, well, you don't exist, Ajahn Brahm. I thought, yes. I always thought that. That's exactly what the Buddha said. Sadhu, sadhu, awesome. And it was so difficult, but it's really good fun. You know, well, maybe for me, not for her. Trying to prove that I exist. When all the things which make you think you exist, your mobile phone, your marriage license, your rental agreement, your address, all those things which, you know, identify you, a monk doesn't have. You know, the only way I got away with it and got a card was because I have, like, two passports, you know, British and Australian. So, well, I really shouldn't count both, but okay, I will, just to get rid of you. So I realised I don't exist. Isn't that wonderful? What are the practical ways to be free from cravings and personal dislikes and phobia? Phobias is really interesting to be able to go into your past lives. Get a hypnotic regression. And that's actually, you find out your phobias, and they've got a reason for that. You know, maybe because, you know, you were died in an air crash, therefore you're afraid of flying. Or that, you know, you were sort of murdered with a sort of a knife, which is why you're afraid of sharp objects. Because many wars have happened and explosions have happened, and maybe that's where the trauma comes from. Now, my grandma, that I told a few people, I think so many talks which I give here, then everywhere, that during the Second World War, you know, she was in London during the Blitz, they called it, and there was bombs going off every evening, hundreds of them, thousands of people would die every night. And eventually that one of the bombs hit the house next door, you know, the terraced houses. You know, just with hardly any sort of space between the next house and the house my grandma and my mother were in. My grandfather, he was off like as a fire warden. He was that age, he was too old to go fight in the army, but he was too young to be a soldier in the First World War. So he was volunteering as a fire warden. So he's outside of the house when the bomb hit next door. And apparently my mother, she doesn't remember any of it, but her arm was lacerated, blood everywhere. But, you know, there's no scars on her arm. She survived. But my grandma, you know, in the house, and she was traumatized by that. But I knew she was traumatized by that because every time as a young kid, when I was in her house having a cup of tea or something, whenever there was a thunderstorm, you know, just the memories of the bombings came back. And she would quietly stop whatever she was doing, and she would go into the stairs, the concrete stairs or the stone stairs, in the little apartment she was in and sit there until the thunder was over. And then she would just come out. It's her way of coping, but it brought back the memories. But there's no sign at all of any other trauma than that. Just how she coped. And you know, she was a very happy, wonderful grandma. She was the one, like most grandmas, they didn't need to discipline you, they just loved you unconditionally. That's why I love my grandma. I go to her house any time of the day or night, afternoon, morning, and said, oh, Peter was my name, do you want some chips, fried potatoes? Oh yeah, that sounds nice. And she would just cut up some potatoes and fry them for me and just give me a plate of chips with... And then when my mother found out, she said, why are you doing that to my son? You know, he spoiled his dinner, he won't be hungry. And then my grandma looked at my mother and said, if he wants chips, he has chips. And that's it. Don't argue. She spoiled me, but she, my grandmas are like that. And just, I love my grandma for that. My poor old mother didn't have a chance because she had to do what her mother told her. And so that's why mothers have more unconditional love. They don't have to sort of train you or discipline you or whatever. That's my mother's job. Grandma's job is just to spoil me. Anyway, for phobia, you just find out why, where that comes from. I usually find out. And when you go hypnotic regression, a lot of times when you find out the cause of it, that, you know, whether it's a past life or not a past life, it actually heals the phobias. I mean, you know, you just get a catharsis and you don't feel so scared anymore. Is recognizing emptiness an important part of our practice? How to meditate on emptiness? It depends on emptiness of what. If at this time of night you start to focus and meditate on the emptiness of your tummy, it will not give you any peace, but it will give you a lot of craving. Empty of problems. So develop the emptiness of having to perform and please people. You're free of that. So, empty of the things in this room. There's lots of space here. Empty of responsibilities while you're here. When you can empty things like that, you can very easily empty the thoughts of your mind. There's no thoughts in there. Just like this room, hardly any stuff in it. And that's why sometimes when people just... they see a room like this and say, oh, you know, we should have like a picture of the Buddha over there. Or maybe just a scene of a sunset. Or like photos of great monasteries, you know, in the world. And after a while, this place gets full of stuff instead of nicely empty. Even this is the shrine over there. Have you ever seen a shrine to the Buddha which has hardly got anything on it at all? It's got a Buddha statue, okay. Plastic flowers and just an old table. That's it. It's got those little things on the side there, which I'm not quite sure what they are. They're golden, like a little tree, like a Christmas tree. And that's it. But if you gave people a chance, oh, they put so much paraphernalia on there. They'd put, I'm not quite sure what they would put on there, little Buddhas, big Buddhas, and all sorts of stuff in there. And it's nice to keep it simple. So this whole room over here is nice and simple. Empty. Which is a very beautiful symbol of the meditating mind. Keep things simple. Keep it empty. Or should we say this, but have many of you actually gone to visit my cave yet? You have? caught you out, no permission. But that's good, but you probably go over there later on. And you know, when I'm not staying here, that's where I live, in my cave. There's nothing, hardly anything there. And it's wonderful, living in a place where you haven't got hardly any possessions in. And that's just, to me, it's just, that's really rich. It's like my wealth is emptiness and space. So when somebody came to visit one of the monks' huts years ago and I took them around, it was like a woman's housewives educational group. They go to all sorts of interesting places in the afternoon once a month. And so I took them around once, I showed them one of the huts, and their response straight away was, if I lived in a place like this, I would get all my housework and cleaning done in such a fraction of the time. Because he had his big house to clean. And so it's wonderful to keep it simple. How much do you need? Why I often blame myself and even feel guilty for the things that I'm not responsible for, e.g. my mum's unhappiness. Can you explain this psychology? You're just brainwashed into taking the blame and feeling guilty. You're not quite sure what you did, but you must have done something. But you didn't do anything. Blaming yourself. So if you do blame yourself, it's like you've had a trial. Remember, like you have a trial at a court of law. And if you have a fair trial, you have to listen to both sides of the argument. You don't just have a prosecutor, you have a defense attorney. But when you consider your culpability, that what people said you did, so your mum's unhappiness, what people do, they just have the prosecutor. And why you're responsible for your mother's unhappiness. And when the prosecutor finishes their argument, straight away, bang, guilty. And you blame yourself. It's totally an unfair trial. So, pause when you feel yourself guilty. It's not the time yet to pronounce guilt or innocence. Listen to the defense, first of all. Listen to the argument why you're not guilty at all. Why it's really unfair that you should even be in a court of judgment being charged for anything. And so when you listen to the defense and give your defense equal time to the prosecutor, in the end you find you can't judge. It's always an open verdict. You don't know why. It's just life. So you can't blame anybody. It's always like the idea of like a trial. Because as soon as you found yourself guilty, the next thing which happens is punishment. And that punishment really causes a lot of problems for people. You don't deserve to be happy. You don't even deserve to be healthy. You don't deserve to have a relationship with another person. You always tend to sort of self-destruct. Every time you get a little bit of happiness, no, I can't. This is just, I don't deserve this. And that even comes with your meditation as well. There's this nun years ago who was here, and she was getting these nimittas. And I thought, wow, you know, she's so close to jhanas. This is really great. And then she kept getting the nimittas, but she couldn't get into the jhanas. And I just was really, this is years ago, and I couldn't understand why. And that's when she came up, she got the insight. She said, I can't go any further because I don't think I deserve to be enlightened. I don't deserve to be so happy. And that was just, first time I heard that, I thought, oh no, of course you deserve to be happy. Why is it that people feel they don't deserve it? They get so close to bliss and happiness and they self-destruct because they don't think that they're good enough. And because of that, if you actually read that book which I wrote, Good, Bad, Who Knows, otherwise known as Don't Worry, Be Grumpy, I put in the back of that book a happiness license. And a grumpy license, whatever license you want. The happiness license I gave to people who just think they don't deserve to be happy. They feel so guilty. You blame yourself for things. So I did this first one. Oh, it's actually, Venerable Caspar is my secretary, so if you want a happiness license, you've got a lot of work tomorrow. I put it on a letterhead, you know, nice letterhead, Bodhinyana Monastery letterhead, and then I did Gothic script, you know, just like a driving license or a marriage license. And I said, this license grants to the holder, and then I put somebody's name down, permission to be happy for any reason or no reason whatsoever for the rest of their life, no matter what they've ever done. Signed, Ajahn Brahm, your teacher. And I'd do a nice signature. And then I'd formally hand it to people, just like you have a license, you know, to practice dentistry, or a license to drive a car, or a license, I don't know what else you need a license for these days, but now I give you a license to be happy. Absolutely ridiculous and stupid, you need a license to be happy, but I give it to you anyway. And people... and I give you a license, you don't have to argue with your husband. You don't have to. You can if you want, but, you know, free from it. So sometimes people think we have to do this. And just a license to be happy was really ridiculous, but it made a very strong point. Why do you need a license to feel good about yourself? Because too many other people who have influenced you, maybe your parents, maybe your teachers, maybe someone else, you don't deserve to be happy. Take that smile off your face. You can't be happy. There's too many other people suffering in this world. You know, you're responsible. You should do more things. And that sort of stuff really is just unacceptable. But having a license to be happy from someone you respect, I hope you respect me, respect my wisdom and stuff. So you get a license from Ajahn Brahm. Yay, I can be happy. Look, that's my teacher said that's much more powerful than my mother. So I can be happy. You put it on your wall next to your Masters of Arts or your PhD or something. Your happiness license. It's worth much more, it's much more effective. So anyway, that's how to overcome that one. I think it was in Germany, in Frankfurt, I just told that story and anecdote. And the person looking after that retreat, you know, he said, look, I want one. So I made him one, and then that monk, he put it online. And I thought on Facebook or something. And then I got over 100 requests for happiness licenses. And I spent the next day just making happiness licenses for the people. They're very effective, though. Anyway, dear Ajahn, the sutta session and guided meditation are both great. Thank you so much. For guided meditation, is it possible to just let us continue to practice in silence once? Yeah, I mean, it's nice to do a guided meditation and just let you go, and just other people can just leave when they want to leave. It's only sometimes I make a promises sometimes. I like keeping my promises. I say, we'll only go for another 20 minutes. So, you know, need to sort of ring a gong somewhere or something to keep my promise. But if you like keeping on going off in silence afterwards, then fine, it's wonderful. How to calm and relax between panicky people? Often I feel I've got affected by their panic energy. I can't avoid them since they're my family. When they get very panic and anxious. What you can do is use your speech and start talking in a slow voice, in a low tone, and your panicky relations will slow down and even go to sleep.
But if you took in a high-pitched voice very fast and very excited, and then they get very excited too, and they get even more panicky because I don't know what you're talking about, but it's a very high tone, it must be something serious, and I'm going to get very happy. Oh, I need to go do something now!
Even just modulating the tone of your voice, that makes a lot of difference. So you can try that, and it's, you know, it's more effective than you think. So anyway, that panicky energy, just calm them down and tell them, relax. Ba-ba-ba-ba-ba. To them, relax. It's worth a go. I have a strict father. When we're in disagreement, he gets upset, and I'm scared that he'll get violent, so I just shut up if the talk and was forced to agree. Please advise, thank you. Remember your father. There will come a time when you are much stronger than he is. And remind him of the law of karma. If he gets very violent, now you're a young person. Soon he'll get old and weak, and you'll be the strong person. Remind him of the law of karma. Ooh. Or as they say in Australia, be kind to your children, because they will choose your nursing homes. You can tell him that. That'll make him walk. Oh, I didn't mean it, son. I didn't mean it. Please give me a nice nursing home. If a spirit in one's house asks for offerings and emptying one of the room in the house for them, what should we do? A spirit asks for offerings? I mean, what do they want? What do you need in the spirit world? You know, do you need a credit card? Because that's what happened. That monks, you know, we're not supposed to accept any alcohol. I did once. I accepted a bottle of Johnny Walker whiskey. I did. Honest. Not that I knew it was what I was doing, because Thai lady, her deceased father or something, always liked whiskey. And she was thinking, how can I get a bottle of whiskey to my father up in heaven, wherever he is? Because usually you give these gifts to good monks, and then if whatever you give to a good monk and you dedicate the merits, appears, you know, to your, whoever you dedicate merits to, up in heaven. And so, now, how can I do this? And she was very smart. So she gave a whole bucket of requisites of toothpaste and soap and towels and all that stuff which you see people offering at Sangha Dana. And she put right in the bottom where you couldn't see Johnny Walker. And she covered it all up. So it was a big bucket, there's a lot of people, a big ceremony. And so here Ajahn Brahm, I dedicate this to my father or grandfather or something. It's okay, and I passed it on to the Anagarikas. I know the Anagarikas, you've seen how it works over the road. And 10 minutes later, one of the Anagarikas come up with a bottle of Johnny Walker and said, Ajahn Brahm, do you realise you've just received a bottle of Johnny Walker? And I had no intention at all. It was hidden so that I could receive it so that... And I told the people, I said, that's not how things work. You know, if you want someone in heaven, you know, you've got sort of, you can do like a telegraphic transfer. Just do some good karma and then they can buy whatever they want in heaven. EFT or whatever you call it. PayPal or whatever. PayGhost. So don't do that again. So, but you know, the monks asked, what should I do with this? And I said, what do you mean, what do with it? Pour it out in the sink. Okay. Anyway, that's emptying one of the room in the house for them. What should we do? The spirit has asked for offerings. They need a place to stay. Because spirits, where actually do they stay? Because they only need a place during the daytime. Because we all know that spirits come out at night. That's when the ghosts haunt people, isn't it? At night time. You wonder just, where do the spirits go during the day? Do you ever see ghosts during the daytime? And anyway, what do they do the rest of the time when they're not scaring people? Right, there's male ghosts and female ghosts. Do they actually, just get married and have little baby ghosts. They go out, you know, when they're not at night time, during the daytime, and say, oh, I like you, and they just, they hang out together. Do that, the spirits, when after they've been married a while, argue like human beings do. So a lot of this is a lot of myth, but every now and again there are spirits around, and a true story is a couple in Perth, and that they had, this a while ago now, they had a TV, and they were watching sort of a movie or watching some sport, and the TV channel would flip over to something else. And first of all, they thought, oh, it's just a fault in the TV, but there's no fault in it. And it would always go to the same type of channel until they realized it was actually the person who lived in the house before who died. You know, they had, ghosts have their own remote. So whenever they decide they don't like what's on the TV, they have to get another one. They just turn the channel themselves. Ghosts have that ability. So this family said, look, this is really, I'm trying to watch a movie or some sports match, and right in the middle it just flips over because this ghost wants to watch his channel. So the solution's obvious. And I told him to buy a second TV. And one was for them, one was for the ghost. And the ghost is really happy now, and he can just watch whatever he wants. And they watch what they want. Problem solved. It's obvious to a monk. I don't know why people can't understand that. Anyway, you mentioned last night that deep meditation needs to be supported by virtues and the teacher of Buddha eventually. Can you please elaborate on this? The virtues, I mean, what is precepts and virtues and morality? A lot of time that's like letting go. Letting go of what you want for your happiness and just letting go and living simply and being concerned with other people. Not about you, but about us. It's always like a renunciation, not taking the easy way, but taking the good way. And it's also the fact whenever you do some act of kindness, you feel just so energized afterwards, with really good energy. It's one of those things you haven't mentioned yet, but when you think of all the wonderful, kind, generous things you've done in your life, you know, I sometimes do that. And like a nice one is this meditation retreat center, because it's right in front of me now. Just now, this meditation retreat center, it took a lot of energy from me, fundraising, just working. You know, I don't just sit around, you do a lot of the work here. And especially this bamboo floor. Builders always are the same. You say, we're doing the opening ceremony in May. Is it going to be finished? Oh, it'll be finished in January, no trouble. So the day before the opening ceremony, there's still bare concrete here. They hadn't finished. And we're having a big opening the next day. And it was the Easter time. And the builders, they went home. They're not going to work on Easter. Doesn't matter how much you want to pay them. And it wasn't finished. And big ceremony coming the next day. What are we going to do? So, when all else fails, you can't find a builder anywhere. Who comes to the rescue? The monks! And there was a lot of monks, and it was headed by, I'm not quite sure if you have the chance to go to the monastery in Kelmscott, which we just started, is Ajahn Santuti. You know, he's the fat, happy monk, you know, you probably remember from times before, Santuti, Ajahn Toots. And I think he was the one. I think they did a video on something, and he was telling people, all the people in Biff, please bring some dim sum next time you come. You remember him? He's a very happy monk. He's just messing around, but he's very joyful. He's a very good teacher now. But anyway, it was 6 or 7 o'clock at night, and this floor wasn't finished. So him, Venerable Mudito, he was in on it. He was now in Newbury Buddhist Monastery in Melbourne. They worked until about 5 o'clock in the morning, all night, finishing this. So what you're sitting on over this side over here was laid by monks all night, staying up, and the following morning there was a big ceremony. They couldn't sort of just take a nap afterwards. And they finished that. And that's what you're sitting on. That's really beautiful. They're so inspiring. They're my monks. So proud of them. That gives me lots of joy and happiness. So that's the sort of stuff. If ever I'm dull or tired, I remember stuff like that. And the stuff which I've done as well. And you get free energy. Because of goodness, virtues, then you use that to empower your meditation. Wow, your meditations just start flying when you realize all your goodness and kindness, what you've actually achieved and done. I mentioned some of those stories when, I already mentioned that story of that kid who actually imagined her spine in a blue nimitta. I mean, that really sort of gives me big energy. But there's also this other email which somebody sent me once. It was only about a year or two ago. And it was from Poland. A lady in East Europe had got arthritis, really severe arthritis. And you see people with arthritis, you know, they're just incredible pain and their body is distorted. All the joints are inflamed. And this lady said her arthritis was so severe, she had to take very strong painkillers with very awful side effects. She had no choice because that's the only way she could just get through one day. It's not hardly much of a life at all. With strong opioids, with trying to just not cure the arthritis, but just to alleviate many of the symptoms. But it wasn't much of a life. But then, you know, she went online and got some of these teachings on meditation, like I was telling today about, you know, you get to a part of the body and you relax and you find out this way, that way, until the feelings get less and less and less. And that's what she did. And she said this beautiful letter, which whenever I think about it, just gets me lovely emotions of kindness and joy and happiness. And wow, you're really doing something for people in this world. And she said she doesn't need the painkillers anymore because the arthritis is totally gone. Thank you, Ajahn Brahm, for your teachings. And thank you for all those people who put it on YouTube, on your website. Ooh, when I think of that. Yeah, jhanas, here we come. You get bliss, happiness, the delight, you know, of virtue. The Buddha called it abhayapaja sukha, the blameless happiness, the faultless happiness. There's much more than that. It's powerful stuff when you think of all the good qualities you've done in your life. Leave the bad qualities aside for a while. Think of all the good ones and you just really get joyful. And it means that you make more effort into making more joyful karma. And that's why the virtue really does support your meditation. Really takes it to another level. Free energy. Can someone experience jhana when sleeping on the bed? How did you? I did that yesterday. But anyway, can you experience jhana when sleeping? No. You can, as soon as you get even close to that, you get nimittas, you wake up. If you have a dream of jhanas, whoop, you sit up straight on the bed, it's too much energy. So, I know I'm very close to one monk who was just really blissing out and just, but I was on a retreat and he was having some really nice meditation and just really having a great time. Went to bed in the middle of the night, sort of started dreaming of going into jhana and straight away just woke up and just couldn't sleep for the rest of the night. Didn't mind at all because it was really good fun. I can't tell you who that monk is because that's breaking my precepts. How do you differentiate from dreaming? Oh, dreaming is just quite dull, but jhana, whoa, you're flying. I mean, not flying, levitating, I mean just just really huge energy. Is it true that through deep meditation it can open up our eyes to see chakra aura? Is it part of psychic power? If you get some deep meditation, you can just notice how energized your mind becomes. And you feel that energy, that's the source of all this psychic power stuff. And you can feel that, you know, ooh, this is big stuff. Don't be afraid, because if you don't want to do psychic powers, it's probably best not to. Just leave them alone, because you just get sometimes obsessed with that psychic stuff. But anyway, certainly you get energized and you can understand that this is where, if you want to develop this, you can do those sorts of things. You can feel the energy, but it can only work if you've got the deep meditations, and the deep meditations only work in that sort of power if you've got virtue. And if you start to abuse that, you lose your virtue and you lose a huge power source for your meditation, and of course the psychic powers fall apart. It's almost like a safety switch, which is a wonderful thing to know. If someone does have powers and they misuse it, they lose their powers. It's not as if that, you know, there's some judge takes it away from you, like you go speeding or drink driving and you lose your license. It's not some being does that, it's just the nature of the meditation. I never actually said this so far, but when you have nimittas, you get to deep meditation, get these beautiful lights in the mind, sometimes your nimittas are dull or even dirty, like stained. And the reason is because your virtue is not up to scratch. You know, you've been a bit lazy, selfish, argumentative. And well, I remember one of the first times I said that, and this in Malaysia and in Kuala KL, and this young man who was my attendant at the time, he came up really concerned. He said, "Ajahn Bab," he said, "what happened?" He said, "I got a nimitta, but it was like a cloth, a white cloth which had been stained, like people had dropped coffee stains all over it, or oil all over it." And I said, "What have you been at? What have you been doing?" He said, "That's a problem. I've broken too many precepts." And that's the result. Because, you know, that you can actually hide precept breakages or something, but it does actually leave a mark on your mind, only temporary, but your mind isn't pure. And because of that, the first time you see a nimitta, it's stained here and dirty over there. But I told him, "Look, you know, I know the loopholes. If you've got a stained and dirty nimitta, don't worry about it. Just look for the part which isn't stained. You know, the nice part. The clean part." Because whenever you've got sort of a cloth or a tea towel or something, there's always one part which, you know, somehow or other hasn't been dirtied. Focus on that and zoom in on it. And if you zoom in on the nice part of your nimitta, it's actually all clean. And zoom in on the nicest part of the nice part. Keep on zooming in on the most beautiful part of the beautiful part. And then you get the beautiful nimittas. I don't know if I should say that, because I'm sometimes encouraging him not to care about his precepts, but it does work. So that's what he did. But there are other people I've known for such a long time, and they really are pure-hearted people. They would never criticize anybody. They give everyone the benefit of the doubt, and they'd always be there at a moment's notice to help you. And they're kind whenever you need a help, they're always there, and fundraising, they're always first there to just, you know, write out a check or whatever it is. They're just beautiful people. And those people that, you know, I know who they are, because, you know, I've just been around a long time, and they're not trying to prove anything. Everything is anonymous. And then when? I just can't wait for them to go on a meditation retreat. Because I know it's just only a matter of time. They've got such a beautiful, pure mind. Their virtue is really strong. And of course, nimittas come up. When the nimittas come up, they're immense. Gorgeous nimittas. Because of all their purity. And of course, they just bliss out and get into jhanas really easy. You know, because pure minds. If you're looking at pure mind, and it's just so bright already. You don't have to brighten it up much, it just comes up just waiting. to actually get stronger, it's already pretty stronger, to subdue the five senses. And they were away, having a wonderful time in meditation. So I've seen that really pure-hearted people. I don't mean sort of goody-goodies who say, yes, I keep the five precepts, and I keep the five precepts better than you do. Now, I keep six precepts. Oh, six and a half. It's not any spiritual materialism, just really good, pure-hearted people. And it's a benefit. You can see they get really good meditation so easily. So anyway, that's how these things help. So that is the Q&A for tonight. So hopefully it was useful. If not, never mind. It's all you're getting. So, sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. Now you've got a photo of me doing my teddy bear. You know, once with the walking meditation, people say, can you do walking meditation different ways? And so I did the kangaroo walking meditation. And many of you have seen that. I just did that once, and it was in Penang. And as soon as I started it, straight away, the mobile phones were out and they photographed it. But Della, if you want to show people that, because tomorrow at the sutta class, you know, if you have a look on those list of suttas over there, you have kangaroo walking meditations on there as well, that same USB stick. Sorry? And then chitta, yeah, it's just, I think, before or after that. It's not sutta class, but it's fun. Anyway, you can look after the question box tonight, teddy bear. So have a pleasant night. This is a very wise teddy bear because he's got a jacket on. All the other teddy bears are probably freezing cold.